People of a certain age will remember with nostalgia those days when they were kids, when boys would be boys and little girls were just beginning to notice them, and vice versa. Kids would roam their neighborhoods and sometimes beyond, largely unsupervised, under strict orders to stay out of trouble and not be late for dinner. Times have changed. If you long to return to that earlier era, read Never Hug a Nun by Kevin Colleen of KMOX Radio. He'll take you back, in his case, to Webster Groves, to Catholic school, and to first love. Kevin joins me in studio. So nice to see you, Kevin. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's the best buildup I've ever had.
Oh, I can't believe that. Well, I'm glad that you're here, and I have to tell you, I read your book over the weekend, and I must confess, it's not like me, but it brought a tear to my eye. At the end, we won't do
really?
The spoiler thing, but yeah,
wow.
Yeah, you did a very, very nice job.
That's
on the book.
Yeah, to make Don Marsh cry, it would...
It's not that tough.
Probably.
It's not
Not since Nixon won, you know.
Oh, God. Let's not go there, Kevin. Lord. How autobiographical is this?
Well, it is a novel, so it's fictional. But, you know, the main character who gets into so much trouble is doing things that I used to do. I mean, we spent a lot of time playing on the train tracks. We got into trouble with the police.
You were absolutely. You were a troublemaker, if you will. Not a trouble seeker, but certainly it seemed to find you.
Well, I thought it was just me and just the gang that I hung out with around Mary Queen of Peace and Webster Groves and around that black train bridge. But after this book came out, so many people would say to me when they'd buy it, they'd say, you know, I used to do the same stuff. Mm-hmm. I had a circuit court judge tell me that after he read it. He said, I used to do that. And then I thought it was just the men, but a woman who is from the Pillars of the Parish Ladies Book Club, they had me over with little crackers and wine, and she was confessing how even as a girl they used to smoke cigarettes on the track and had a point system for how many windows they could break on the automobile transport cars that were going by. She felt personally responsible for the metal guards that the railroad put up on it.
You know, I have to tell you, I grew up 1,000 miles away in New Jersey, and we as kids, and a few years before you, by the way, but we were doing the same thing. I mean, the tracks were a big attraction, and there are ways to make caves, as you guys did. You had a fort, but ways to do things like that. I guess kids all over the country were doing it.
Yeah, you know, it's the one area. It was like your babysitter, the Missouri Pacific train tracks. And I wouldn't recommend it now because the trains are a lot quieter. They'll sneak up on you. But back then, it was just a way of life that, the as you said in the introduction, you know, the moms, they're back home pregnant, making Toll House cookies, and the dads are in downtown St. Louis fighting the corporate fight. So the kids would just, in the summertime, run up to the tracks, smoke the lady cigars off the catalpa trees, and dig little forts. And when the slow freights would come by, it was our, you know, our U-City Loop trolley that they're proposing. We already had that. We'd ride it down to Ben Franklin.
But you used to play a dangerous game on those tracks. At least the book gets started that way with a young lady friend, I might add.
Well, that part is fictional, I have to admit. In the very beginning of the book, the girl and the boy run and jump in front of a train because the girl believes she can get a wish by jumping in front of a train. Mm. And that's kind of in there for thematic reasons, but I won't spoil that. But there are some people who play Dodge Train like that. I never did that.
Thank God. It's a dangerous game indeed. One of the things that struck me, Kevin, and I'm sure there's a legal reason for this, is you changed the name of Mary Queen of Peace, one of the most well-known, I guess, churches and in the area and schools, and you changed the name of Lockwood to Main Street.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I offended the MQP fans, but I wanted to make a distinction between where memories blur into fiction. You know, Mary Queen of Peace has its own brand name, their own goals, and I don't want them to be mad that there's a book about a bunch of juvenile delinquents from Mary Queen of Peace who are always getting in trouble. But a lot of people from MQP have said they got a big kick out of it. And I understand the Monsignor. My mother goes there still. She said that the Monsignor was hawking the book from the podium, which seems sacrilegious, you know.
No, except to the author. Got to take a break. Kevin Colleen is our guest. We're talking about his book, Never Hug a Nun, which is semi-autobiographical, we can say, talking about youngsters growing up in Webster Groves in the 1960s, 1966, as a matter of fact. We'll be back with Kevin Colleen in just a moment. If you'd like to chat with him and learn more about the book, learn more about him, feel free to do so. 382-8255 is the number. That's a 314 area code for our friends up north. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL On Air, and you can reach us through Facebook. Back with Kevin Colleen in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Kevin Colleen of KMOX Radio, and now author of Never Hug a Nun, available in all good bookstores and online, I'm sure.
And in some bad bookstores, too.
You know, you asked me a question just before we came back from that break, and I'm going to put that one to you. This has a lot to do with Patrick Cantwell, who is the young hero of this book. If hero is the right word to use.
Who can't do well. He's always in trouble.
He's always in trouble. And his first crush, do you remember yours?
I do, and I should not name names, but I will tell you, very much like in this book, it was an electrifying moment in first grade when I looked over, and there she was. She had shiny brown hair and brown eyes, and she was writing in cursive when the rest of us could only print. And I've told my wife about this, but she was offended. I said, please don't be offended, because, you know, unlike your wedding day where you make a cold decision of the will, and it's also emotional. But when you're young and you have that first crush, that first, you know, sticking your hand in the electrical socket, it's as if warehouses full of endorphins that have never been used just dump into your bloodstream, and you're just swept along with this, you know, you just want to gaze at her and just, you know, hear the music of her voice, and just, if she would say your name, or the big thing was if you would by accident share the double drinking fountain, then you thought, this must be meant to be.
At what point does it change from being attracted by cursive writing to other things?
Well, that's after this book, I guess, of the high school years.
Well, yeah, very much so. It's it must have been, I don't want to use the word cathartic, but going back and reliving your childhood, you know, brings with it a lot of different things, a lot of different emotions, I would guess.
It did, because you come to realize how dull we are as middle-aged people, that we try to keep emotionally even-keeled. But when you're young, whether it's your first crush or the first time a terrible curse word crosses your mouth and you feel that guilt for it, I mean, your spiritual conscience is just really ramped up. You're having all these new experiences like hopping trains or stealing from Ben Franklin or, you know, learning about the fall from the nuns teaching about Adam and Eve. So everything, as I went back to remember it, was just so vivid. And I thought, that's when I was alive. Right now, I'm just typing little sentences as a journalist. You know, the sewer bill could go up. You know, that's the height of my excitement.
You've got kids of your own.
We have two boys and two girls from ages 22 to 12.
Wow. That's quite a range. How did going back to your youth affect, if it did, your relationship with your kids?
It made me thankful, especially for my boys, how well-behaved they've been. I have two boys who are like A students. My oldest son, Kevin Jr., he's a senior at Webster High. He has physics clubs meetings around the dining room table with his friends, and they talk about algorithms. I don't know what they're talking about. But I'm thinking by the time I had been their age, I'd done so many bad things and been at juvenile court and just, you know, all the disappointments a boy can bring his parents I brought to them. But my kids, I thought, they've really been good. I mean, they don't put their dishes in the dishwasher and they throw the cap of the toothpaste skittering across the sink, but, you know, they're pretty good.
Do you really think that you were so much different than your peers during this time? Because at least one of the kids brought about in the talked about in the book, one of the buddies, one of the Fort buddies, seemed like a, you know, he had a lot of bad potential.
Oh, Kurt Logan.
Kurt.
Yeah, you know, in every group, there's somebody who's got the extra special cuss words or has seen the R-rated movie that his divorced dad took him to, and he sort of gives you a window or initiates you into higher things or lower things. But Some kids, on the other hand, were very good, who, you know, they were the sons of the parish leaders, so the dads who would make the Pinewood Derby car and put weights in it, or collection plate passers, people who were, you know, had good haircuts with trimmed sideburns.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have a call. Someone wants to get into this conversation. Let's bring them in. Ken in St. Louis, you're on the air with Kevin Killeen. Go ahead.
Kevin, Ken Walk, we worked together at the Journal, and I just wanted to congratulate you.
Oh, Ken. Ken was my editor on the crime beat. He kept telling me to keep the humor out of the assaults on Cherokee Street. Thank you.
My pleasure. I look forward to reading it.
Well, were you a troublemaker yourself? Could you see yourself in a book like this?
No, I was the oldest of five. So you're as the oldest of five, you end up being too much in charge of everyone else to be a troublemaker.
Well, you could have vicarious delinquency by reading it then.
Oh, good. I'll look forward to it.
Ken, are you and Kevin contemporaries, about the same age?
I'm a little bit older than Kevin. I grew up in the 50s.
Ah. And give me just a very quick thumbnail, if you will, of what life was like as a kid in the 50s and early 60s.
I grew up in the city near Jefferson and Gravois, and so it was much different than Kevin's, I think, in terms of being more blue-collar and, gosh, I don't know how else to describe it, but... probably it was similar in that families were the center of what was going on, and you know, we found Tar Grove Park quickly and Fox Park quickly, and they were our railroad tracks for the most part.
So you were of also that era where you kids would leave first thing in the morning and come back at dinner time, and they'd better not be late.
Very much, and if you were the neighbors were on you to get home, and they were calling your mother or father to let them know that you weren't where you were and where you weren't supposed to be.
Ken, thank you so much for the call. Not much mention of neighbors in your book. I guess the church became the neighborhood, if you will, and the neighbors.
Yeah, well, let's see. You know, there was a part where I had to go door to door to try to sell raffle tickets to the neighbors, and there were a lot of doors slammed. But the church was the overarching authority structure. That's why it's called Never Hug a Nun, because the main character didn't like all the nuns who were just – they were like sentries at every turn, you know, ringing the bell to come in from recess or checking up on everything.
But it really had an influence, the church, on every aspect of your life. I mean, it's what the parents talked about. It's determined to some degree who you were going to marry. It just really was huge.
Yeah, and I can remember how, you know, discussions about, like, nudity would come up one time, and this is in the book. You know, my brother wanted to sleep like Tarzan without any clothes on. And then, you know, he was told, well, no, that nudity is a sin. And so, and then the character says, well, once I went to school with nudity under my pants because we were out of underwear. And the brother says, that's not nudity, that's stupidity.
Another thing that certainly caught my attention in the book, and again, trying to determine what might or might not be autobiographical, are the parents. Were these your parents?
They were. The father worked downtown at a food company. My dad worked at Pet Milk, and he was always fighting the corporate wars and clunking his briefcase down at the end of the day. And my mother, who just sort of ironed and listened to big band radio, she would bring him in an old-fashioned, which is all the rage now, I understand, mm-hmm. because of Mad Men, but back then it was actually contemporary. And, you know, he'd sit there and she'd talk about all the trouble we were in and relate what she heard Jack Carney say that day or on big band radio. And, you know, and my dad often would stare over her head at a picture of a Civil War battle scene while she was trying to relate the latest news. You know, he thought that was the more interesting sometimes.
Your mother is still alive. Your father also with us or not?
He passed away about 5 years ago from Alzheimer's. And my mother is 83. And she's going strong. We still go to garage sales on Saturdays when the weather's good. She loves to look for junk and
My wife used to meet your mother from time to time at Webster. We lived not far apart for a period of time. You were on Algonquin, and we were just a block or two away from that. Yeah. He seemed like quite a guy. I mean, his approach to dealing with his kids and dealing with Patrick, if you will, seemed very, very appropriate and very wise.
Thank you. The thing about my dad, and this is in the book, that if we were arrested, for instance, we would be watching through the wire glass window as the other parents would come in swatting their kids or yelling at them and think, what is Dad going to do? And then when he got there, he yelled at the city workers and blamed them for his high taxes in Webster and thought they were being impertinent. And then he let us have it in the car, though. He'd say, you're going to be punished. This is a terrible thing, you know, robbing the Ben Franklin or whatever we did. But, you know, you're still a member of this family. And he always had that thing, if you're ever in trouble, you can always come to me. And that was a great backstop to have in the back of our mind. Maybe I used it too much, though.
The thing that came through to me was the fact that he was very, very measured. There was no swatting a kid on the back of the head or, you know, using any kind of force or violence.
My father was very liberal. Both of my parents were influenced by that Dr. Spock book, Raising Babies, I think it was called. And there was a chapter in there that said you should reason with children. And they took that literally. I think I had like two spankings in my life.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time they'd say, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And I came to almost love those talks perversely so that maybe I got in trouble, because that was where I really felt close to my dad when we were in trouble together.
Yeah, I know a lot of kids when they grew up, they felt a lot of kids.
It was our bond.
You know, a lot of kids felt they would rather be spanked, for lack of a better word, than talked to by the old man. Maybe that was your case as well. Let's go back to the phones and bring in some folks who want to talk with Kevin Colleen. Mary in Kirkwood, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Don. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mary.
You probably don't remember me, but we used to work together at a particular store I won't mention. You were in the pharmacy?
Oh, at the Target in Kirkwood.
Well, okay. Well, there's the advertising. yeah, that the old one. Anyway, I just wanted to say I'm shocked to hear this about you, because I thought you were the kindest, gentlest person that I knew. And certainly, you know,
that was my Target training. It was all a lie.
Was it? Well, it was a good facade. But anyway, and I thought you were wonderful then. And it's just my shock now is finding out that you're working at KMOX instead of NPR. You're kind of like the Ira Glass to me of St. Louis, but. Anyway, I'm thrilled to hear about the book, and I'm going to buy it now that I'm aware of it. But I wanted to tell you also, I don't know if you knew this, I went to St. Peter's in Kirkwood.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, surprised to know that you were hanging out at the railroad tracks and smoking cigarettes. We should have spoken more during high school days. But at St. Peter's, we used to hide at recess between the convent and the church and smoke cigarettes, which is a terrible thing to admit, but hope my mom isn't listening.
I don't know what it is with you kids in the Catholic schools, but all these secrets are suddenly emerging.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
I think it was maybe because there were so many good rules that the rules just sparked your appetite to disobey them.
Probably true, yeah.
That is an inclination of people of a certain age. In your case, it was, I think, 7 years old when you were getting into all this trouble.
Yeah, you were a bit young, I have to say. I don't think we were doing that until probably sixth grade or so. But, you know, the petty theft and all that, I think that's almost a rite of passage for people that go to Catholic schools, or at least back then it was. It was all, you know.
Well, yeah, and another thing, they were preparing us for First Confession, and we had to have a lot of material.
That's true. You know, something I still don't understand is, why is it that you have to say 10 Hail Marys or Our Fathers? How is 10 any more effective than one? Other than to, back then, we had to sit up at the altar and do it. So unless it was just the shame of being up there that much longer so other people could see how bad your sins were, I don't see the point of it. But I'm kind of parted from the Catholic Church, so I don't know if they still do that anymore. Do you?
Yeah, I think they do still have that where you have to, you get an assignment, your penitence, to say a few prayers after you come out of confession.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Glad you had a chance to reminisce a little bit with Kevin.
Well, me too. Take care.
You too.
Thank you, Mary.
Thanks.
Let's bring in Dick. He's on a cell phone. Dick, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning, Don. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Seeing you on Thursday afternoons after I tape my weekly spot over there at the station, and I look forward to reading your book. I discovered an interesting parallel between St. Louis Catholic schools and Baltimore Catholic schools, where I grew up. I discovered after Bob Reynolds became the chairman of RCGA that he was a year ahead of me at Immaculate Conception grade school in Baltimore.
You know, we should say, just so people recognize you, this is Dick Fleming, the former head of the RCGA, and you're admitting you were a delinquent too?
I had nuns, St. Franciscan nuns for 12 years and Jesuits for 4 years in undergraduate school. And when I had my first class in graduate school at Wharton at University of Pennsylvania, I remember thinking to myself, this is the first time in my life I've not had nuns or priests, and who walked in my first class at Wharton but Father Richard Leone, the only priest on the Wharton faculty. And so I can share with your experiences of Catholic school. And I finally, when I got to graduate school, after that first class, I had nuns and non-priests. But I enjoyed the nuns, and I enjoyed the Jesuits.
Well, Dick, you'll enjoy the book, too. I recommend it very highly, Never Hug a Nun by Kevin Killeen. Pick it up. It'll revive some memories in your case, too, I'm sure.
I will look forward to it. Best to you, Kevin.
Dick, congratulations on your retirement.
Well, I'm retired from RCGA, but not retired, and I'm enjoying my new life.
Well, it's nice to know that you're listening to this program from time to time, Dick. Thanks for that, too.
You're very welcome.
Right. Thank you.
Enjoy your show.
Thanks very much. Let's take one more call. We'll bring in Art from South City. Art, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Don. You know, I'd probably appreciate his father's writing of his boyhood days rather than what your guest's book is all about. But it's a wonder, why doesn't people write more about the 30s and 40s growing up amongst those days? When you went into the school room, you heard children should be seen and not heard. You're here to learn before you can earn. There was really a disciplined type of a atmosphere that prevailed among individuals. And, you know, we used to always go ash pit hunting. My bikes came out piece by piece out of throwaways from people's throwout items. If you could beat the scrap dealers. I sold newspapers at the age of 7 to 9, Globe Democrats, 3 cents a piece. So you had to sell 3 to make a penny. You were always looking for some kind of a way to make out to help the family resources go a lot further. And I'm just wondering, when did the atmosphere really change within our educational system?
Well, it sounds like you were from a good, responsible generation that was making your way through the Depression. But we grew up in the age of hyper-consumerism with full refrigerators and TV shows and sitcoms and air conditioning. And just the gravy was rolling and we just, you know, backslid.
There was a lot different type of a character built into the society when people came up through those hard times.
There is a special breed that came out of that Depression area. Art, thanks for calling, Art. Art's an octogenarian. He's well into his 80s. He calls fairly frequently and grew up during that tough time. And it's always been my observation, perhaps yours too, that people who did or the children of the people who did were very, very different. They were very frugal. They had a whole different approach to life than the boomer generation, if you will.
I agree. And like I said, the people who were the boomer generation, by contrast, I can remember my grandmother correcting us, you know, you better be more careful with your spending or your behavior or you will end up on Biddle Street. That was where the poorhouse was downtown. And she was always threatening that we were going to somehow have a terrible fall in our family and all end up on Biddle Street.
Well, fortunately, that did not happen. Kevin Killeen is our guest. His book is Never Hug a Nun. We'll be back to continue our conversation with him, and we'd like you to be a part of it at 382-8255, 38, that's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Kevin Killeen of KMOX Radio and the author of Never Hug a Nun. That's what we're talking about on today's program. You know, much as we've indicated, Kevin, much of your story deals with the fact that you grew up in a Catholic parish and what an influence that had in your life. That was happening during a period of some transition for the Catholic Church. How aware were you as a youngster of what was going on?
I remember when the nuns stopped wearing their habits, and there was talk from the pulpit of Vatican II, and also the Monsignor said, now they're trying to bring in the sign of peace, and a lot of you men are hoping you'll be standing next to a dizzy blonde when it's time to shake hands. But there was, and my mother would remark, she was more of a traditional Catholic than my father. She would remark that, you know, it was different. We used to not be able to eat meat on Fridays, and they're kind of loosening it up. And maybe that goes back to what Art was saying, that things were not as hard scrabble and disciplined.
Yeah. And what about the nuns? I mean, was that the time when that population was diminishing, or did it precede that time?
It was starting to thin out, and this is a completely amateur opinion, but I blame it on the movie The Sound of Music, because as soon as that hit the airwaves and you could see, like, hey, you know, Maria didn't have to be a nun, and she had her mission to have a family. But it was probably, you know, the women's movement and jobs opening up more so than that. But the nuns were thinning out, and we started to have more lay teachers. And then also when the nuns stopped wearing their habit, it was almost as if, you know, the monster on Lost in Space was no longer as scary, and, you know, some of the moral authority was gone.
Interestingly, the period that you're writing about here was about the time when The Sound of Music was coming out. What about changes? This may be digressing too far than you want to go, but what about the changes within the Catholic Church since then? I mean, obviously, with what's going on now in Rome, they're selecting a new pope. There's been a lot of turmoil within the church. As someone who grew up a good Catholic, how do you view that?
Well, I think it's sad, all the scandal that has happened. And I was blessed. I'm talking about the sex scandals in the church. Yeah. I was blessed in a parish where that didn't happen, at least when I was there. I mean, the worst thing we had was an Irish priest who drank a little. And he'd yell at you in confession if you talked too loud, you know. But I think it's sad that there has been sort of a diminishing of the brand, and it's not as strong as it used to be. The priests have lost some of their currency.
Sure, it'll be interesting to see how the conclave turns out and how whether there's a new direction of some sort or whether things stay pretty much the same with regard to the more conservative approach.
And I'll tell you who I'm rooting for selfishly is Cardinal Dolan, because somebody at my publishing house, Blank Slate Press, has a relative who knows him and slipped him a copy of Never Hug a Nun. Uh-huh. So I have this image where the white smoke is coming out and the new pope comes out and it's Dolan and he's waving Never Hug a Nun, saying, oh, I'm going to put that down, but, you know.
Well, let's just hope that the book is not the subject of the source of the white smoke. we wouldn't want that to happen.
That would be the best use of it.
Let's go back to the phones. Leona in Bourbon, Missouri. It's your turn. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Leona.
Hi, Leona.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, you guys. This is a very interesting program. And the other old fellow that called in, well, I'm an old lady, and I grew up in a farm in Michigan, and I want to say that it's the same as the other old fellow said, and I want to know when the big change happened, because, you know, we would just do everything right. We would help on the farm, and if we did as kids anything wrong, the whole neighborhood knew it, and you know, we wouldn't have dared. So when did this happen? Back in the 40s, when I was growing up, we towed the line, and I'm just wondering when the change happened.
Leona, thanks.
Why it was so sudden.
Leona, thanks for the call. I don't think it was necessarily very sudden, and your question is directed to Kevin, but you and I think, are contemporaries. And Kevin, what occurs to me, and you really sort of answered this call with Art or one of the earlier callers, it just seems to me that every older generation looks to the younger generation and basically says, we were better, we did things differently, and it was better in the old days. And your kids will be saying the same thing 20 years from now.
Well, although with my kids, I look at them and I say I was worse than them. So I think to Leona and Art's point, there's a time when a country, a nation gets fat and everything's at ease, and maybe there's a backing off from strict rules or too many people are working and there's not supervision. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's a good question.
Your family used to have dinner together every night?
Those were the days. You'd sit around the table and the 2% milk was poured. And the beef stew, if we didn't like it, we called it beef poo. And, you know, we'd had it. My father actually brought home a conference room table from Pet Milk, and my brother Jim used to secretly shoo his string beans in there and close the drawer. It was painted shut once, and we found years later there was some penicillin string beans in there that mildewed up. But we would sit around, and, you know, what did you do today? And then eventually the parade of great 60s TV shows. You know, there's a black and white TV in our room, and Batman, Lost in Space, all those took over, and there was less conversation.
We had a guest on the program last week or the week before by the name of Bruce Feiler, who has written a book about family love, if you will, and family togetherness. And he kind of poo-pooed the family dinner thing anymore, saying if you really analyze what people talk about at the, quote, family dinner, it's, you know, pass the ketchup and pass the milk, and there's not a whole lot of conversation that goes on. And that probably was pretty much that way a generation or two ago.
Then again, even if you're watching Batman together or listening to your dad correct your brother about how to hold your fork, there's a shared experience that gives you ideas that you all have in common, and you go through it together. You laugh at the same things on the TV show.
And at least you have the opportunity to have some sort of discourse if you choose to.
And one of the greatest things I remember is my dad, he was a basketball player in high school. He would, at the end of the meal, wad up his napkin and lob it down the length of the table, and it would splash into my mom's milk. She would say, Tom.
Let's go back to the phones. And here's a call from Webster Groves, the old stomping grounds, from Roger. Go ahead, Roger.
Oh, this is Roger Gennari, uncle of the Gennari boys.
Well, hello, Roger. Your nephew, Jim, my best friend. We got into many troubles together.
I do remember. And you know he's now a commander in the Navy.
Oh, yeah. He was on the news. He's the one who pulled the live grenade from the soldier's leg.
Yes.
Uh-huh. He was,
yes.
But he was up on the train tracks. And I'd like to think it was our training up there running around being chased by the police that led to his heroics in Afghanistan.
Well, it's just your book is wonderful, by the way. I've just finished it.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to hand it off to a good friend of mine. But it was just so pleasant. I had my own experiences like that. As you know, I went into the seminary, and then I left after 10 years. So I'm married now with three kids, but all adults. But I do remember those Catholic grade school days. They were wonderful. But mostly I just congratulate you, and Jimmy still talks about you, and I'm just glad.
Thank you, Roger.
Roger, I would think, I'm not speaking for Kevin, that he would prefer that you not hand the book off to someone, that you go out and buy one to give them.
Tell them to buy their own stinking book.
Well, I got it as a Christmas gift from my brother's widow, and it's a signed copy, so I don't know if I should make a profit, but I don't want to sell it to my friend. But anyway, good point.
All right, Roger, thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Let's bring in Jerry from O'Fallon, Missouri, another regular caller. Jerry, hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm glad I tuned in, so I've been made aware of your book. I'll be certain to read it very quickly. I grew up on the other side of town in Ferguson. But when you mentioned Jack Carney and KMOX, I honestly have to say, as an adult, most of my cultural tastes were formed by listening, especially to Jack Carney, playing music that was way before my era, but I really kind of became addicted to, and watching KPLR because they showed, you know, what are now termed classic films, you know, before the VCR or cable or anything. You had to tune in to watch a fourth-generation 16-millimeter print of the Maltese Falcon that was missing parts. But, you know, that kind of got me those are my same interests today. So even though we're on a different side of town, I guess that's the power of mass media. And thank you. I'll read your book.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you know, the TV back then, The Maltese Falcon and all those movies. And that's part of the thing that these kids talk about is there were so many World War II movies that were just now coming onto TV. And so you would see Von Ryan's Express or The Great Escape or The Train. And remember the movie The Train? With
Absolutely, yeah.
And you would, as a kid, you would start to think, well, how could I fantasize this into my, you know, the tracks are Nazi Germany and the police are the Nazis and somebody's chasing me. And we had all, we were living in a fantasy up there that was from all these movies.
Yeah.
Hogan's Heroes.
And there was some Hogan's Heroes I never quite understood. It was funny, but, you know, making a sitcom out of that situation just always boggled my mind.
Well, that's, it glorified sabotage and sneakiness, yeah. And that's what we were all about.
But they made all the Germans seem like dunces, and, you know, that clearly wasn't the case, and given what they were doing. Back to the phones. As time allows, let's bring in some more folks. David in Bourbon. Hey, another call from Bourbon. Go ahead.
Hey there. Yeah, I know time is running out. Just real quick bio on me. I'm about to turn 66, and much of what you all are discussing today speaks to me. But, you know, regarding art and Leona, and I'm friends with Leona, a dear woman, and this is in no way to dismiss the struggles of growing up in the 30s, certainly not. But, you know, for me anyway, I mean, I had no mom. I had a middle class. I had all the stuff that you were talking about. Grew up in Webster, went to Annunciation. But I was pretty fatalistic, and so were a lot of my peers. I mean, I remember hearing about strontium 90 from atomic bombs being blown up in Nevada. And, you know, I heard that it was in milk, and I loved milk. And I thought adults were idiots, largely, and that my future was in doubt, to say the least. I thought the Soviet Union and this country were going to just vaporize the world around me. And, you know, I graduated from college, and here I am still, but it was that really affected me and a lot of my contemporaries, I would say. So anyway,
there was a lot to worry about, in other words, back then.
Well, I just didn't think I was going to make it to a ripe old age. I thought the adults running this country and the Soviet Union just were heading for the abyss, and I didn't see them as role models or anything. It was just, you know, they just screwed things up. And so, let's enjoy it while we can was kind of my theory there for a while, along with a lot of my contemporaries. So anyway, thank you for that.
David, thank you so much for the call. You know, I can, as well as David, remember doing those drills by going under the desks in school because that was the way we were going to be protected from the inevitability of a nuclear attack. Those were tough days, living under that cloud. I have an email here from Christy. I just loaded your book on my Kindle. Welcome to the 21st century. My husband will love this book, too. He went to St. Francis de Sales through high school graduation. My family lived in Arnold and went to Immaculate Conception, church and religion classes. Your stories are reminiscent of my four brothers.
There's always some brothers in the background who get in trouble.
Yeah, well, it just shows that that your story is not unique. Now, I know some people are wondering why we haven't talked about the title, Never Hug a Nun. And the reason I have not brought it up, and I think maybe you'll agree with me on this, is that there's kind of a spoiler alert. If you really examine what that's all about, it tells too much of the story.
Well, I respect that. In just a general sense, though, it's because the main character does not like the authority structure of the nuns, and he likes to keep his distance from them if they ever try to get too affectionate.
But we don't want to take it beyond that point because I think, again, at the end of the book where there is some emotion, there's
yeah, that something made, there. Almost made Don Marsh cry.
Almost made
Don Marsh cry. Kleenex alert.
How difficult, Kevin, you're a reporter down at KMOX, and I know you're going to be covering the election later today. How difficult has it been for you as a hometown guy to cover hometown things?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, you know where the streets are, you know where the back doors are and then the names, and it's been a lot of fun. I'm glad that I've been at KMOX for about 17 years. My hair was dark when I started.
At least you have here.
You know, it's a great profession where every day is different. and you don't know if there's going to be a plane coming in with the landing gear not working, or there's going to be a bank robbery with bullet cartridges on the street, or a mayoral election, you know, with snow. And it's just, it's fun. It's always different.
You get a chance to take a break from some of that with your Whole Nother Story series, which is outstanding, by the way. I'm a big fan of that.
It's a complete foolishness. They found I was injecting too much humor into the news, so they tried to divert me into having a regular kind of a humor column. It's about things like three-legged dogs and people that cheated on their science fair projects and won. Just, you know, little stuff like that.
How much time are you able to devote to that and taken away from your news reporting
responsibilities? Well, that's always a constant stress because, you know, I'm sort of like Sherman's army. I have to get the news, but I can grab a few chickens, a feature along the way, you know. I hope to fit it in.
Okay, our time is just about up. Never Hug a Nun is the name of the book, and you have a signing coming up, I understand.
Yeah, you know, I have not, speaking of Sherman's Army, I have not made a foray into St. Charles yet, but this Saturday I'm going to be at the Barnes & Noble in St. Charles from, I think, noon to 3 at the Barnes & Noble. But you can also get the book, as the one lady did, on Kindle. It's on Amazon.com. The Webster Groves bookstore right in the heart where the scene of the crime, Left Bank Books, all the same page books in Creve Coeur, and Subterranean Books in the Loop.
Okay. Well, we hope you have great success with it, Kevin Killeen. Thanks so much.
Thank you again.
I enjoyed it. Never Hug a Nun is the name of the book. That is Kevin Killeen. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Yvonne Logan and Shirley Breeze about the role of women in public life. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.